You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
They're back together again. Eric and Jeff are reunited friends. All movie DS is back together again. Do you remember the day when Jeff was away? Well, he changed his mind and turned around. Back to stay. All movie DS is back together again. Watch a movie, play a game until the day is done. Who's going to make a podcast with me? So much fun. All movie DS is back. Yes, I think Bill Grace are back. Oh, Jeff and Eric are back together again.
Oh, hello. It's Movie BS with Bayer and Snyder, your movie internet podcast brought to you by OneOfUs.net. I'm your host, Eric D. Snyder, and that's my co-host, Jeff Bayer.
Hi, everybody. I'm the host of Movie BS with Bayer and Snyder. That's my co-host, Eric D. Snyder. Let's get to it. Let's just dive on in.
We begin every show with an iTunes review. We have one here today. If you write us an iTunes review, we'll read it on the show in old-timey voice, as I'm about to do now. This is titled Un Podcast para Todos, and it's from Marty Reeder. Caballeros y damas, les voy a ser sincero. Este podcast es el uno para lo cual han estado buscando. Jefe y Eric prestan voces de expertos sobre las películas, mas lo hacen con dignidad, humildad y, quizás lo más importante, el humor. Una de familia de muchos niños, no tengo oportunidad de salir a ver muchas películas, y en las que veo en la casa tiene un límite. Por eso, las opiniones de Jefe y Eric son tan esenciales para escoger las pocas perlas entre la gran cantidad de basura que se encuentran en las pantallas, cajas rojas, o sitios de web. Si no lo han averiguado por sí mismos, hoy mismo deben de descargarlo y dar un regalo a sus oídos. No les va a desesperar.
I feel terrible. I actually, before you started speaking, I hit the Spanish button on my computer.
No, that was in Spanish. I was reading it in Spanish. Thanks, Marty Reeder, for that review.
Yeah, well, maybe.
I don't really know what you said. I got the gist of it.
I picked up on some things.
I like the part where he said, Jefe y Eric. I knew what that meant.
King, that's King Eric.
The boss and Eric. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Marty. Anyone, write us a review. We'll read it on the show, even in Spanish, apparently. Who knew? Hey, Jeff, what's our first movie?
That's a great question, Eric. Our first movie is War Dogs.
War Dogs. Am I saying that right? War Dogs.
Dogs. Mm-hmm. What are they good for?
Almost absolutely nothing, as it turns out. Todd Phillips made this movie, you know, of the Hangover trilogy.
That's right.
That guy. And he saw how Adam McKay of Anchorman and Talladega Nights made The Big Short. And he's like, hey, I want to do one of those.
Hey, me too.
Hey,
I want to play.
I'm a wacky guy who can talk about a serious real life thing that happened. And so War Dogs is Jonah Hill and Miles Teller. And they're a couple of bros. This is
based on a true story.
Yeah, this is BOATS. That's my new acronym. BOATS.
This is Totes BOATS.
Based on a true story, BOATS.
How has this not been a thing?
I don't know. I'm surprised. I can't be the first one to have noticed that.
Well, as long as you put it on the internet, then mm-hmm. you'll be first.
I'm trademarking it. So, yeah, this movie is BOATS.
BOATS.
And a couple of Florida douchebags, douche bro, stoner bro. How many times do you say the word bro is used in this movie?
Times two too many?
I'm not exaggerating when I say it's in the film at least a million times.
Yeah, not only that, there's so much, casual pot use that it like doesn't even feel like a thing.
And it doesn't. A couple of idiots. David is Miles Teller. He's our narrator, and he's the one who still has hints of a conscience. And Jonah Hill is Ephraim.
And he has none.
He has none.
He has no problem doing anything for a little cash involving wars and guns and whatnot.
Well, they were best buddies in middle school, and Ephraim moved away. Now he's back, and he's got this new scheme. This is down in Miami. Of course, it's in Florida. And yes, Ephraim has been buying guns seized at government seized from criminals, I guess, at government auctions and then reselling them, and now he wants to expand. This is the thing that you could do. I guess we could do this. I guess.
It seems like, yeah.
The Pentagon. Know if
that's, yeah.
After Halliburton got all those sweet contracts and got in trouble for it, so then now the Pentagon has to let anyone, any contractor bid on a job.
It's the kind of movie that as it's going along, I didn't have many notes to take because I didn't feel like I was getting to know many people.
No, there's no, it's no people to know. It's just these two, and they're
and
very,
it's really weird because
what you see is what you get.
The core of it, Miles Teller's character, David, he has a conscience. He's the narrator, but he has a slight one. Like he's against the war, but then he's willing to do
stuff no problem
for money
profiting
because he's got a fiance that's pregnant.
He's got a concerned and pregnant girlfriend because the reluctant criminal in these stories always has a concerned pregnant girlfriend.
But
here's the thing: when he starts out, he's a massage therapist making $75 an hour, which is good money. But he feels unfulfilled. So that's his motivation. Right. He needs something a little more challenging, a little something, you know, just that feels more, makes him feel alive. So they start become arms dealers, and
Ephraim's just nothing but slime. Like nobody would think that he's like looking out for his friend. Everybody is on pins and needles as far as like, hey, keep your guard up with this guy. There's
everyone knows he is trouble.
This guy.
Here's the thing:
we know him. He's creepy.
Here's the thing. Ephraim, he's boisterous and tubby, and he's obnoxious, and he's got that horrible laugh. But somehow also we're supposed to believe that he's good at charming people, that he's a great chameleon and liar who's great at selling people.
He understands people, and he knows what they want. And here's the thing with Todd Phillips. Every Todd Phillips movie that you see, you can point to the character that Todd Phillips thinks he is. He writes himself into these movies. He did it with The Hangover as Bradley Cooper's character.
You know which one of these do you think he is? Does he think
he's
he is?
Ephraim?
He doesn't think he's Ephraim.
He totally thinks he's Ephraim in the sense of he's a slimy charmer. Like you have to. I think in all sincerity, you have to throw out the unappealing visualness of Jonah Hill in this role,
right?
Because
I don't think
Todd Phillips sees it. I don't think Jonah sees it. And with this. I think this character needed a desperate hint of that Bradley Cooper charm.
He needed to not be 100% loathsome and miserable. There's not one redeeming quality to him. Right. So why would Todd Phillips think that that's himself?
Because Todd Phillips does not think this guy is like, if you talk to him, he'd be like, he's got a way. He's got a way about him.
And that's
what I think.
That is one of the problems with this movie. And it reminds me of Pain and Gain, another Florida boats movie, also about criminals, in that. That movie and this one, the characters are like eight or nines on a 1 to 10 scale of awfulness, but the movie thinks they're only sixes.
Yeah,
it's like this movie is aware that Ephraim is a bad guy, but then David is supposed to be sort of the better one, but he's really not any better, and the movie lets him off easy.
It does let him off easy, and he's got blinders on with this idea that like. The cash that he's getting, the lifestyle that he's having, all of this stuff, it seems like he's just in it, but you can't even say why he's in it.
Right. There's no motivation to be doing this. Because here's the thing, what they're doing with these contracts is legal, but Ephraim is intent on doing it in an illegal manner. So they're cutting corners and making falsifying documents, buying weapons from countries you're not supposed to buy weapons from. So they're taking what could be a legitimate business and making it, doing it illegally. And David knows all this, and he goes along with it. Yeah, for no good reason.
And the weird thing is, I was fully on board with understanding this world. Like I wanted to go on this adventure.
Sure,
totally fine with it. And if it's with these two, okay, these actors are good enough. Even though these characters aren't to my liking, I'm going to go on this adventure and learning about all of this information and how it can be done and how like you can look at a soldier and be like, boom, $17,500. How can I make my money? All of that is very interesting. But to hear them talk about like the idea that, you know, all war is a business opportunity and that sort of thing. The movie never feels that. It said it. And just like this narration from David, I don't know this to be accurate. It feels like when they were done with the movie, they were like, you know what? let's over explain this with a narration. I think that's what the movie needs, because
I agree that it over explains it, but I felt like it was probably written like the movie would collapse without the narration. Like the screenplay wouldn't make any sense without it. There's so much of it.
I just kept feeling
it's
like,
it's very tell do not show kind of movie.
Yes, and what they're telling, though, it seems like half the time it's like, yeah, that's basic enough. You don't need to speak on this. Like you're actually walking through this scene right now, so you don't need it.
Phillips thinks that this is one of those fascinating, crazy, outrageous real life capers. But when it gets explained, it's not that outrageous. Like certainly not outrageous enough to justify this detailed retelling of it. And it's not where you're like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. They did that. Wow. It just, maybe we've seen too many of these. Maybe we live in such weird times that nothing is surprising. But it's like, all right, yeah, a couple of Scarface fans got it over their heads with the government, and so what?
They're magically in front of the right people at certain times, and as a stylistic choice, it was so weird that Todd Phillips would choose to freeze the screen on occasion,
all the time, and, yeah, freeze frames,
and have that be a blurry image. Like half the time, like it was like you're freezing it out of focus. Why are you doing that? And then he'd freeze the next one and it'd be perfectly focused. And it's like, that's not a style choice, buddy. Like it there's no good reason.
I wouldn't mind the characters being awful. One, if the movie acknowledged how awful they were, but also if they were funnier. It's just not funny enough to Ephraim isn't even like a you love to hate him kind of character. He's not funny enough to rise to that level.
There's not a ton of zip to this movie. That like it feels like it's supposed to be really fast paced, and the musical choices almost like Suicide Squad. It's like, look, come on, this is a really peppy
super
song.
On the nose.
Here we go. We're gonna have fun now.
He even uses one of the same songs as Suicide Squad.
Yes, it does. And it just doesn't, unfortunately. And
no.
Here's something that's a little bit weird. In the preview, most of the previews are showcasing something that doesn't actually happen until I think 3/4 into the movie, which is just odd. I mean,
maybe this comes from you skipping previews, but that is super common. I feel like that's super common.
I'm just out of the game so long that it's like I felt like I kept listening to this preview in the theater.
I saw it many times. Anyway, I think the movie has its moments that are standalone into the scenes that are funny or interesting, engaging situations. But just overall, it just doesn't. It can't find a tone to make these repugnant people palatable as entertainment.
I just wanted to be on this journey with somebody else. Like, honestly, I wanted to be on the journey with Bradley Cooper's character because he was dead enough.
He's an arms dealer.
Or removed enough so deep into it that, like, I could enjoy it and let it go a little bit more. But again, with these guys, I never figured out what made David tick. And you can't have somebody who's speaking that much and giving a narration and has the girlfriend who's not doing anything except for asking him to tell the truth and him continuously not doing that, and that being her only use to the film. You can't have all of that and still at the end not be engaged with the character, and that's what it felt like to me.
The real David has a cameo in the movie, by the way.
He's
the guy playing the guitar at the old folks' home. It's the kind of movie that would do that, by which I mean it's a douchey movie, where they would have the douche that it's about be in the movie. And you were right. The only reason that the other one was not in the movie is that he was still in jail when they shot the movie.
Yeah, there
I'm
we
sure
go.
He would have been otherwise. I give it a C.
It's a 5 out of 10 for me too. Again, interesting story, just wasted.
And then next up, Kubo and the Two Strings. Mm-hmm. Nice little animated thing from those guys at Laika.
Laika Studios,
right here in Portland.
That's right. Well, I think they're technically in Beaverton.
Whatever.
I'm just saying.
This is their Laika's fourth movie. Coraline, Paranorman, The Box Trolls, and now this one. And this is Japanese, or it's set in Japan. Right. It's not actually Japanese.
This is also Travis Knight, Phil Knight, the Nike guy, his son. He's been an animator at Laika, and I want to say, is he the CEO? He's something big. This is the first movie he's directed.
Right.
From them.
And it's, you know, they, what they do the stop motion for little models and figures, and it's incredibly detailed and beautiful to look at. And the story is, it's in old-timey Japan, and there's a mom and her little baby wash up on the shore. Baby's got an eye patch. That's Kubo. And when he's about, was he about nine or thereabouts when everything happens?
Yeah, I would say, that's good. Sure.
He's got an eye patch, and he's we don't know where that came from, but he's a storyteller. He tells stories in the village every day.
And he's got some magic that we're not quite sure if everybody knows it's magic or if it's all accepted.
It seems to be accepted that it's a magical thing that he has. He does origami, but the paper folds itself.
It's impressive.
Yeah, and then it moves around, and so he tells these stories, and his little origami figures act them out. And, yeah, there's some magic involved.
I wrote down, I need to understand this magic. That's what I wrote down early. But before that, don't forget, this narration, as opposed to War Dogs, grabs you like crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a little kid's voice, and it's just like, if you must blink, do it now. And it's just like, it's a great, great way to suck you into a story.
About to weave you a yarn.
That's right.
His mother tells him of his father, who was a samurai, Hanzo.
She also explains that he's kind of like a gremlin of sorts. He shouldn't go out after
dark. Oh, yeah, young Kubo's not supposed to be out at night. Because
there's a couple of other rules, too. I can't remember.
Because the Moon King will find him. Well, it turns out the Moon King is his grandfather. It's a whole big thing. But basically, you got the Moon King, and you've got the evil sisters. This is mom's sisters, so Kujo's aunts, who are some kind of like kabuki-faced witches
Kujo?
Or something.
Did you say Kujo?
Possibly. So then Kubo is on. He's on an adventure to get some artifacts to defend against this mystical.
And he's got a sidekick known as a monkey.
Yeah, a monkey. It's a little monkey charm that he had that becomes a real
very,
monkey.
A very no-nonsense, take this very seriously kind of monkey, which I liked.
For a monkey, she is very serious. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's the voice of Charlize Theron. Noted famed Japanese actress Charlize Theron.
Please. Then we've got Beetle, Matthew McConaughey.
And then Beetle was... He doesn't have any memory. He's a samurai, kind of, that has been turned into a human-sized beetle, kind of, and he becomes the other sidekick. And he's very goofy and very much looser. So, you know, he and the monkey clash. The monkey and the beetle don't get along. But they're both trying to help Kubo. Trying to help Kubo get these three things he has to get and to defeat the bad guys. You know, one of those kind of stories. Fantasy, mystical, magic, self-folding origami, all that stuff. And it's very imaginative. It's a very, very imaginative story.
Yes. I love the creativity behind this story. There's many layers to it. It feels like a fully realized world that I'm just trying to catch up with. And that's a good thing.
And it's a story about stories. It's very much about stories and storytelling and about how all stories have an end and about how we believe that the stories that we're told, including stories about ourselves, stories have a very profound impact on us, on our lives. And I like that. And it, like I said, it's beautiful to look at. We saw it in 3D, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
All right.
Some good looking 3D.
Yeah, yeah. When it's one of these, you know, using models and stop motion animation, mm-hmm. It makes more sense to be in 3D because it's sort of a imaginative, made up world anyway. I feel this way about this movie that I felt also, I think, about Paranorman and the Box Trolls, which is, that's fine. Like I feel like I'm supposed to love this more than I do. And on paper, I like everything about it. There's nothing I don't like about it. It just didn't.
Maybe you need to take that piece of paper and fold it into something different. Look at it a different way. Because I, on the other hand, like all of Laika's films, I really enjoyed it. And I didn't quite love it. That's how I feel. I'm the same as you. I keep wanting more.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty happy every single time.
Yeah. And there's some emotional connection that's not quite happening for me here. And I don't know if it's because the story is too rigid. The story has a lot going on. There's lots of mythology to it. And it's a very ambitious story to tell, considering that it's all original, not based on anything that we're familiar with. To make up such a detailed and elaborate world is ambitious. And maybe that's part of it, that I just – because it is so foreign, so new to me, that I just couldn't quite make the emotional connection. I don't know. I don't know. It's good, but it's good. It's lovely.
I think it's really good. It's beautiful to look at.
It's funny sometimes.
It'll charm you. And once again, just like all the other Laika films, not a little kid story. It's a kid story.
Yeah, not super young, but really yeah. Probably six and up, I guess, probably. I don't know.
I don't know how that works.
I don't care what you do with your kids. Anyway, but it's good. I give it a B.
I give it an 8.
Yeah.
I would have that's BS approved territory for me, for the record. But not for you.
Oh yeah, no, not for me. No.
B's been, not
but it's good though. But it's good. Yeah. Speaking of movies that are good. You ever see that old film with Charlton Heston called Ben-Hur?
Actually, I was thinking about it. And I might need to rewatch that thing. I want to check the running time because I'm a little nervous once I...
Oh, it is super long.
Remember how long it
is. That movie is very long and very wide.
Did it just finish now?
It just,
is that how long it
just
is?
Just finished now, yeah. No,
1959?
But that's that's a classic. Everyone knows that movie.
Yep.
Now there's a new Ben-Hur.
Thank goodness.
And he's not your grandfather's Ben-Hur. Let me tell you some interesting facts about the novel Ben-Hur.
Have you read it?
No. But I know things about
yes,
it.
Yes, please speak upon it.
But I know things about it. The
All right.
The full title of Ben-Hur, the novel, is Ben-Hur, A Tale of the Christ.
Oh.
It is very much a Christian story. It's told in, I think, 8 sections. Yeah, 8 sections. The first section is all just not even about Ben-Hur. It's just about Jesus. It's the Jesus, the three magi, the story, and then Mary and Joseph and all that. So very much about Jesus, and then he's involved more in the story with Judah Ben-Hur throughout. And I mention that because in the movie, in this new movie, everything to do with Jesus feels like it was added later, like it was an afterthought. And I thought, oh, how can we wedge Jesus into this movie?
It does feel like not everybody had to be there the day that Jesus was on set.
And not just like inspired from screen time, but
right,
in the way
right.
that Christianity fits into the story, it all seems very. It's like this movie is about Christianity the way that Jaws is about the 4th of July.
They did not want to speak about him until you were very much stuck in your seat. I think it was like I don't think he was spoken by name until maybe like 2/3 into the movie.
No, and that's fine, and that might even be in keep that. I feel like the Charlton Heston one might have been the same way, but just I more amusing to me was just that thematically, the whole point of the story is supposed to be that this character, this Judah Ben-Hur, after going through everything he goes through, becomes a Christian and forgives and all that. And he was converted by seeing Jesus. And in this, that seems like – it almost seems irrelevant. The way that it's portrayed in this version, it seems like it was unnecessary.
Yeah. Like instead – it wasn't about
– He kind of got there on his own to the whole forgiving thing. He
uh-huh.
kind of got there by himself.
Yeah. I mean he noticed what that JC was going through. And,
right.
Maybe that affected him.
Kind of clinched it, maybe. But
yeah,
it was
the clincher.
it was the African. It was Morgan Freeman, who I guess is God. So I guess that makes sense. But
it
Morgan,
makes sense.
It was his character, kind of more. Didn't he have a conversation with him about getting over it or something? I forget.
Get over it.
Something. No. I feel like there was a conversation where he imparted some words of wisdom, some life lessons.
All right, so wait. All right, so as we're going along mm-hmm. in this Ben-Hur film, I was just like, okay, I get it. These two who are really close, they're going to be at odds. It's obvious. That's what we're doing.
People may not know the story loosely. You got Judah Ben-Hur. He's a rich, fancy Jew in Jesus' time. That's Jack Houston playing him. That was Charlton Heston before. And his best friend / adopted brother is a Roman named Masala.
And Masala is he feels bad about being adopted. He can't get over it. And apparently, on occasion, there's references from the family that he's adopted, but otherwise they seem pretty cool with him.
I do.
But
and,
he's He's angry about
and he's a Roman living in Jerusalem, which is occupied by the Romans. So Romans aren't very popular, and so So these are the brothers, and who turn into rivals because Messala becomes the Roman soldier commander, and then there's an incident.
Oh, and there's zealots.
There's some of the local Jews who are trying to get rid of the Romans, overthrow the Romans. And Judah Ben-Hur is like, no, dude, chill out. Like, take it easy. We don't need insurgents. We don't need terrorists going on here. I agree with you, but take it down a notch.
So all of this feels like, I would say, a quality made-for-TV kind of ABC movie of the week. Mm-hmm. Not something that you're going to see on HBO, but it feels like that. It's that run-of-the-mill thing.
You'd show it around Easter.
Then there is a sea battle. And I have to say, a sea battle from the perspective of a slave below a ship is something that I was very engaged in. I was shocked at how good it looked.
Yeah, it was pretty
and
good.
I was ready to go, wow, maybe the first half of this movie kind of blew, but I'm in it now. Let's do this. And the movie did not want to do this. It wanted to go back to that feeling of made for TV, ABC, and even the big chariots, which I think everybody, when you hear Ben-Hur, that's what you think of, is the four-horse chariot race.
One of the greatest sequences ever filmed. One of those impressive sequences ever filmed and edited.
And if you kids love the circus, I mean, come on. it's referred to as a circus, and it just amused me because it's a word that clearly doesn't fit, but they were using it like crazy in this movie, and that was funny.
Well, it fit then. It doesn't fit
it
now.
It fit then. It doesn't fit now, and that's how silly I am. But what's weird here is Judah Ben-Hur's total motivation. Toward the end of the film, I was just like, is this about survival? Is this about revenge? What's going on here? Does he really just want to know what happened to his family and then he's at peace? And that's the problem with this. You don't have that kind of issue with your Bravehearts or whatever, or the Gladiator. You know what his motivation is. You know how he's trying to do it. And here it felt a little weak in that regard. And I wasn't necessarily minding that. But at the same point, that made-for-TV vibe just made me go like, you gotta clear this up for me or speed it along, one or the other.
Yeah, I wasn't engaged at all with him, and I kept trying to put my finger on what was missing. And I don't feel like I feel like he was motivated by revenge. He was unfairly, unjustly enslaved, sent away into the galley ship by his best friend. But I just never felt compelled. I felt like the movie was going through the motions of telling this story, this familiar story, familiar to a lot of people, and just going through the motions and not getting it. And there's a weird change they made to the plot, different from the book and from the Charlton Heston movie. It hinges on when a leader is coming through town, and in the book and in the old movie, somebody from Ben-Hur's family accidentally knocks a tile or a pot or something off the roof onto the leader going by. But it's an accident. But it looks like someone an attack. And so and Messala knows that it was an accident. But to show us a firm hand against the Jews, sends Ben-Hur away anyway. In this version, they've made it an intentional act where one of these insurgents shoots an arrow and Ben-Hur tries to stop him. But then that raises the question, but so then why not just turn him in? Like, why? That's what I didn't understand is why Judah Ben-Hur takes the fall for this guy. There's no reason for that. It doesn't make any sense why he would do that.
The only reason I felt he did that while watching the movie is like, well, I guess because he's kind of a kid, because he's young. But
yeah.
That was it. And I wondered that as that was happening. I was like, this seems weird. Why would he let him go?
Why are you helping him escape? Yes, hold him down and say, yes,
situation's done.
Sorry, buddy. I agree with you as a Jew, but hey, we can't shoot arrows at Pontius Pilate.
And because most importantly, up until that point, that is all Judah kept saying, was like, hey, let's not raise a ruckus. Let's be nice.
Yeah. And so it was a weird choice on the part of the filmmakers, and then it doesn't work at all with the character, I don't feel like. And then it goes on. For a long time, and then it's over. The chariot race is fine. It's a good sequence, but if you've seen the original chariots Chariot Race, there's no comparison.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so unnecessary. The whole thing's just unnecessary.
I couldn't figure out where one of the actors was from. And of course, he was
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, I give it a C.
The sea battle's good. I give it a 4 out of 10.
What would it be without the sea battle?
A 3. It would
that
be.
That bad? Oh, wow.
Yeah. Or a lower 4. You'd have to look. You'd have to
a smaller 4.
It's be smaller.
Yeah, lowercase 4.
A lowercase 4, as my son occasionally says.
Better luck next time, Ben Hur.
There has to be a next time.
Probably.
Oh.
I assume they only made this one because the rights were about to lapse or something.
And then Marvel would get their greedy hands on it.
Can I tell you an interesting fact? Another Ben Hur fact. I wrote about this for Mental Floss. It should be up by the time you hear this on mentalfloss.com. The very first movie version of Ben Hur was a 1907, a little 15-minute version of it.
Wow.
And in those days, nobody asked for permission before adapting books into mm-hmm. movies, because the whole thing was so new. Like, no, it just didn't occur to anybody. But the Ben Hur, the publisher, sued the filmmaker, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. The filmmaker tried to argue that it didn't count as a performance of Ben Hur because there was no dialogue. It was just pictures. How could that be a performance? The book is full of dialogue, basically. But it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and it was this court case that established that you have to ask permission before making a movie out of an existing property.
Wow.
Which in 2016 you say, well, duh, but in 1907,
yeah,
that was this, but this is what established it. Ben Hur.
I actually said, wow. I didn't say duh.
One might say duh.
Yeah, one could.
Anyway, that's everything I know about Ben Hur. Actually, that's not. There's way more in the article. It's funny. Also, it's funny just to read old-timey court cases, like the way they describe the process of making a movie when it's all brand new. They're like, they stretched a strip of film across a projector and exhibited the images in theatoriums. Anyway, what's now? Question of the week.
The question of the week.
We asked what pre-1960 movie should be remade and how would it be different now? Sort of in honor of Ben Hur.
Yeah. Gar.
Gar.
Two R's. So you got to say gar.
Gar.
He says, some like it hot in space. Done. I'm a fan of anything ... in space.
Yeah. Yeah. You add in space. There's so many movies that would be better if you added in space to them.
It really would be. So wait, let's think about that because that's all he says. He doesn't give any of the details.
The Godfather in space.
They would have to be they would actually dress up like another race.
Oh, like aliens, like another alien
race. Like another
species.
Alien race.
It's like they're putting on like rubber tentacles or something.
Yes. It'd be bad.
That
and then one of them genuinely falls in love with an alien.
With one of those aliens, yeah.
And then so it's like, yeah, they have a lot to deal with.
Would the aliens in this be CGI or would they be humans? Because it's funnier if they don't look human at all, like if they're
right. No,
totally,
I agree.
Yeah, monstrous.
Yes.
Well, we can work on that. Whatever the budget will allow, I guess, probably.
True. We haven't been greenlit yet, so we don't know what kind of shape we're in.
Some like it hot in space. Then Kurt says, Ace in the Hole. I like this idea a lot. Ace in the Hole would translate pretty well to modern journalism's clickbait sensibilities. If you don't know this movie, you should see it. Ace in the Hole from the 50s. And it's about a guy. There's a guy gets trapped in a cave-in, like in a mine thing. And there's a journalist. He's alive, but he's stuck. They can't get him out. And the journalist prolongs him being stuck in there to make the story last longer. And it becomes this whole media circus. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't heard of it. This is, yeah.
It's good. It was also released under the title The Big Carnival. Anyway, but it's like a really like dark, funny satire of media sensationalism. But yeah, so the modernizing it, here's what Kurt says, is you'd have, I think he means, all right, Channing Tatum.
This is what I was assuming, yes.
He just said the last names, but Tatum is a tabloid journalist who lucks onto the story of Leo DiCaprio, I assume,
right,
getting stuck in the landslide. The town wants to keep it quiet, so instead of a media circus, Tatum secretly videos interviews with Leo while dragging out the rescue efforts. The story eventually breaks. Leo dies. The media circus arrives, but now Tatum is the focus and is subject to all the tabloid journalism he subjected others to while waiting trial for his role in Leo's death. Oh, that's interesting. It takes a little bit further than the old one did.
Okay, nice.
But yeah, there's the thing, watching that movie, like, it's amazing how prescient it is, and how, like, when I saw it when I was a freshman in college in 1992, and then I thought, wow, this feels modern, and like, still now it still feels, I guess it's a story as old as time, exploiting human suffering for page views.
Dan, who is one of our patrons.
Yes.
So we are now forced to read Dan's stupid answer.
Finally, someone has claimed patron privilege and forced us to read the answer. Yes, go ahead.
Citizen Kane, but futurized like Gattaca somehow. But clearly we have to do this somehow.
Somehow,
that's what
yeah.
we're going to do. But to make it truly futuresque, Nicolas Cage as Charles Foster Kane. He's thinking like Wicker Man or Bad Lieutenant, Nick Cage, and directed by Werner Herzog.
That would be crazy. Yeah, that could be good. It would be very crazy. Make Charles Foster Kane very wacko.
Well, here's the thing that Dan has 100% correct.
Hmm.
If our internet society heard that we were having another Citizen Kane,
a remake of Citizen Kane,
everybody would freak out and hate the idea. But then you say two names and suddenly you're like, well, that's just crazy enough to, yeah, I need to see that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's
like,
true.
It's that.
Nicolas Cage and Werner Herzog. That would make it okay.
Crazy enough, it's not crazy enough to work per se, but it's like, oh, I like train wrecks.
Yeah, it's not just crazy enough to work. It's so crazy it won't work.
That's right. But now I need to see it.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Nice job, Dan. And Dan, good job on forcing us.
Yeah, anyone who is one of our patrons, go to moviebs.com and you'll see the red button there for Patreon. Anyone who's a patron can force us to read their answer on the show.
That's right.
By the way, the Werner Herzog Citizen Kane remake also would be the good subject of a documentary about the making of this movie with Werner Herzog and Nicolas Cage.
Yes, that's the thing. This movie, it's making money at both ends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like as they say.
Right.
Edward... This is another good idea. He says a modern remake of Sullivan's Travels. Sullivan's Travels was, what was that? Well, here's the modern version. This will refresh my memory. It was a writer wanting to see like the underprivileged during the Depression, wanting to go around and see the common man and all that. So he's saying this could be a producer, like a Weinstein type of producer, who makes an effort to understand underprivileged lifestyles after a couple of egregious, insensitive Oscar bait films and pressure from social media and news outlets. It develops as the original does. He is presumed dead. He's imprisoned. Oh, that's right. When he goes to visit the underclass, that's right, he disappears. But with modern tabloids, social media, and tensions in class and race. Yeah, that is definitely a story that could be updated. Especially, mm-hmm. I like that angle of having made a couple of ridiculous, like it's the director of Crash or something, or the producer, some ridiculous Oscar bait movie. He has to out and like really, really see how the underprivileged live or whatever. I like it.
Oh, the movie would actually start with a scene that's even like more ridiculous than Crash as far as like race relations go. And we wouldn't know we're watching a movie. And then he'd be like, cut.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right.
That sort of thing. Like, you know, Roger Rabbit kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Ooh, animated and funny.
Yeah, that's right. And Dallas says, finally, this is our fifth. I could go for a remake of the smash 1888 film Round Hay Garden Scene. Here's what you guys need to do. Pause, go to our Facebook page and watch the 2 second film that he linked to. That is the 1888 original.
This is supposed to be like one of the first things ever actually filmed. And it's just a couple seconds in a garden. Yeah.
And here we go. In the remake, we would have the versatile Nicolas Cage. He's getting a lot of work this week.
A lot of work from so far from both people who do not spell his name correctly.
That's true.
There's no H.
And he would be man. Cate Blanchett would be woman one. And Helen Mirren would be woman two.
Again, interesting.
Go watch the 2 second clip. It would be set in the retro-futuristic 1950s, and Man would be an astronaut who's just returned from his mission to Jupiter. While he is at his coming-home party, he gets bad news about a friend he made on Jupiter, and he must exit the party early. Little does he know, Woman 1 and Woman 2 have nefarious plans for Man. And just who is Man 2? His casting and role are top secret. Will Man be able to escape the party safely? Will he be able to save his friend? Who knows? Dallas, good job.
I feel like Dallas is really elaborating on what's in the original film there.
I mean, if you've seen the original, you get the sense of Jupiter. I'll give him that.
Embellishing the story there. But I guess they would have to expand it.
Yes.
Because it wasn't very long.
I have an answer for this. I would love to see a high-quality remake, because, of course, you know, that's what all of these would be, of Jimmy Stewart's Harvey.
Mm, yeah? Why?
Mainly because of how we now diagnose, understand, prescribe mental illness, depression, whatever the case may be. Mm. And if you see that movie, the thing that I retain from that film is the joy that Jimmy Stewart's character has toward life and towards those close to him.
Yeah.
And the idea kind of is, do we crush this in terms of his potential delusion?
Right, because he's harmless.
And I would love that play in the modern society.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That would be a good play.
How that would play out. Yeah.
That would be a good thing to modernize. They should get on that.
Thanks.
Who would be our Jimmy Stewart? Tom Hanks?
Tom Hanks might be too old.
He might be too old. That's true. Yeah, actually,
let's go Ed Norton.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Hey, you're normally good at this. Tom Hanks, Ed Norton. What do you think their age difference is?
I'm going to say there's 13 years between them. I think Ed Norton's about 45.
I shall now tell you. Tom Hanks is 60 years old.
60.
Right on the button. And Ed Norton is 46.
Oh, you know what? Yesterday, Thursday, was his birthday, August 18th, 47.
Oh, so wait, did you say 13 years?
Yes, I did.
Oh, that's creepy.
Nice.
That is creepy.
I'm exactly right.
You got that by a day.
Yeah, he just turned.
Whoa.
47.
Huh. You got to take that kind of luck to the casino, I believe is what you're supposed to do now, and gamble your life away based on the fact that you just got that right.
Sold. Question of the week for next week. Now, next week, this week was celebrity Edward Norton's birthday. Next week is...
They know whose birthday it is next week.
Next week is Eric D. Snyder's birthday. Next Friday, our birthday episode, August 26th, my birthday. And so, in conjunction with that, in honor of that, tell us a true story about one of your birthdays, and we'll make it into a movie. So tell us a true story about something that happened to you on your birthday or pertaining to your birthday. And you can email us at moviebspdx@gmail.com. Or you can post it on Facebook.
You can go to moviebs.com. You can find our Facebook page and more.
And more.
We have a complete database of every gosh darn movie we've reviewed here on this show.
Mm-hmm, like 1,015 of them now.
Just start clicking. Enjoy yourself.
Also on our website, you'll find all of the results of the Summer Box Office Challenge.
Oh, from like past years when
past
we used
years,
to do that?
Mm-hmm. Up to and including the current year, which is now officially over. This year's Summer Box Office Challenge officially ended. The last movie in the draft was Pete's Dragon. And so now we both have our totals.
Unofficially... this ended just shortly after our draft. That's how I felt anyway.
You gave up immediately. You gave up and were making excuses for yourself immediately. The body wasn't even cold.
I was right. All I have to say is I was right, Eric. I was right. Mm-hmm. No big deal, but I was right.
But yes, the final official results, I had 645.4 million, and Jeff had 480.7 million. for a difference of $164.6 million, which is the largest difference that we've had, by the way. So I'm not bragging. I'm just saying that I won by more than anyone else. Oh, no, that's not true. I once won by more than that. Two years ago, I won by $174 million.
Here's what I do. I either win or I don't try. That's all I do.
It is interesting that, well, the first year we only did five movies each, and so that was sort of an anomaly. It's hard to count that. But generally, when you've won by less than I win by when I win.
Yes. Your margin of victory is larger than my margin of victory because I like teasing it
out to make it close.
And giving you a sliver of hope. That's how I like to beat you.
Interesting. Interesting.
Whereas you get nervous about winning and losing, so you beat me to death right away, and then keep kicking me when I'm down. And that's what you did here.
Oh, by the way, I also still not bragging, but that $645.4 million is the most that anyone's ever gotten in this game.
Oh.
It's no big deal.
Well, it's not because, box office keeps going up.
Sure, it keeps going up, yeah. And it's also no big deal that if we were to add up my 54 total movies and yours, that mine would total more than yours. Like, I've made more overall than you have.
Right, and that's not a big deal because...
No, it doesn't, because we're not doing a cumulative.
I've wanted to add layers to this. You haven't, so that sort of thing does not matter at all. You're totally right.
Doesn't.
Right.
Now, the stakes of the bet, since you are officially the loser, I'm going to give you a haircut the night before Fantastic Fest.
All right, let's pause it right there.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about this haircut.
All right. No, it will not be flattering.
The one thing that you had said, and we had a slight miscommunication on this, and I just want to clarify it for my future.
All right.
I need to know this now.
Okay.
You were like, and no clippers. And
right.
I took that to mean, got it. It's not going to be like a shaved head.
Right.
So here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping this won't be the case. Is the only way to get rid of this bad haircut going to be to shave my head completely? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, are you going to leave me in such a state that the only thing I can do to make my head look slightly normal is to shave my head? I hope that's not the case.
I guess anything's possible, but I feel like that would not necessarily be because of the shortness of it. Like, I could still leave you plenty of length and screw it up so bad that there's no way to even it out or fix it or whatever. I don't know what barbers can do with fixing a haircut.
Man. So you are really going to just do your worst.
Well, yeah, that's the idea.
And
I'll leave you some length, and you're letting it grow out. You haven't gotten a haircut in a little while. You're letting it go. So I'll have plenty to work with.
I think I'm giving you something like 12 weeks of growth.
All right. well, that's more than I'm used to.
Yeah.
Leave you length, but it will look awful. The point will be to make you look embarrassing and for you to feel humiliated as you walk around.
I am very comfortable with looking awful for a week. And I was just curious if I'm going to be stuck then, because I don't love how I look with a shaved head.
Right, sure.
I didn't know if that's what then. That is
fair and reasonable. I will try to leave you something that can be repaired.
Okay.
Also, you'll have to spend a week living my lifestyle as a Mormon. Which here are the official. Here's what I've determined are the official rules for that. This will be a week of no coffee, tea, alcohol, or tobacco. No profanity. That means particularly no taking the Lord's name in vain.
All right. So here's my question. If for some reason one of those happened.
Sure.
There needs to be a consequence.
Well, I guess we're
because
just,
I want to keep track of this.
Right.
I want to honor this correctly.
You could put a,
I don't know what comes out of my mouth. I never keep
I know
track
you don't.
Of it.
I know you don't. You could put a rubber band on your wrist, and if you catch yourself, give yourself a little snap, I suppose.
Oh, okay. I like that. I'll give myself a huge snap. That's great. Done.
But it's more the honor system.
Right. And I will try.
Sure.
But again, think about how little honor I have.
Well, and I did take that into account.
Yeah.
Which is why I've set up the cameras and the microphones in your house.
Oh, what? Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense then.
And then also you'll have to go to church on Sunday. People who are familiar with Mormon church services know he doesn't have to go to the whole 3 hours. I'm not a monster. Just the sacrament meeting.
Most importantly, I get a stand up in like it's an airing of grievances that happens at these things. Is that right? So I get to like everybody that's wronged me, I get to just like talk about. Is that how it
you're
works?
You're thinking. I'm not sure what religion that is, but it's not Mormons. No, sorry. I thought of these probably won't come up, but if you're going to be living for a week as a Mormon, any voting you do that week will need to be for white Republicans. Just be aware of that, obviously. And you can't baptize any infants that week. Any infants you baptize must be, or children you baptize must be at least 8 years old.
Oh, okay, okay.
No infant baptisms that week.
Oof, that's going to change things.
Well, yeah, you might need to reschedule. So there you go. Now, have you decided what week you're going to do this? I know you wanted to do it sooner rather than later, you were saying.
I think there's a chance that it'll be the week before Fantastic Fest.
Okay.
I think there's a chance that I can do it starting September 11th.
All right. Oh, perfect.
That way I'll have two things to remember September 11th.
Right. Good. Well, that'll be fun. And, of course, listeners will keep you posted on all the fun things that happen.
Yeah.
And that brings us to the end of the show. What did we learn today?
Hey, Eric, we learned that some movies were better than others.
Yeah. Yeah. We keep learning that lesson.
you'd think it would
stick.
In.
Yeah.
No.
War Dogs. Okay. War Dogs, not good. Not particularly good. Not terrible, but not...
It's forgettable is what it is. Like, at the end of the day, you're just like, let's move on to something else.
Kubo and the Two Strings is lovely and imaginative and creative, and it's good.
You know what I think?
Hmm.
I think it has a chance at Best Animated for Oscar. I think it might take it from Pixar.
Oh, yeah, could be. Yeah.
Like has never won it, but I think there's a chance.
This could be their year. Sure. And then Ben-Hur, also not good.
No, it's not good. Hmm. But they had to remake it. Had to
they had it. To. The people were clamoring. Question of the week. In honor of my birthday, it's August 26th. And gifts and tributes, welcome. Tell us a true story about one of your birthdays, and we'll make it into a movie.
Done and done.
And so that's it then. So until next week, for Movie BS with Bear and Snyder, I'm Eric D. Snyder.
I'm Jeff Bear.
Thanks for listening and good day.
I said good day.